Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Tom Waller. I'm chair of the club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program, which is entitled Economics Without Ecocide, Building a Whole Earth Economy. We invite our audience to visit us often on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine program events which are held here at the club. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker. Peter Brown is a professor of McGill University in Montreal, Canada. His teaching, research, and service are concerned with ethics, governance, and the protection of the environment. His appointments at McGill are in the School of Environment, the Department of Geography, and the Department of Natural Resource Sciences. Peter is the first full-time director of the McGill School of Environment, where he strives for integrated and collaborative program initiatives with many of McGill's other academic departments. Peter received his BA degree in the early 60s from Haverford College outside Philadelphia. He then went on to attend Columbia University in New York City, earning his MA and PhD, which was in philosophy. Before coming to McGill, Peter was professor of public policy at the University of Maryland's Graduate School of Public Affairs. While at the University of Maryland, he founded the Institute for Philosophy and Public Policy, as well as the School of Public Policy itself. Peter established the school's environmental policy programs to operate not only at the university's College Park campus, but also at Maryland's Department of the Environment and at the United States Environmental Protection Agency. Peter has held numerous administrative positions within the University of Maryland system. He has taught at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs, at the University of Washington, and at St. John's College in Annapolis. In the early 1970s, he was a visiting fellow at Battelle, Seattle Research Center, and Assistant Vice President for Research Operations at the Urban Institute. He is currently a research scholar at the Center for Humans and Nature. As expected, Peter's experience and expertise are in high demand, and he serves on the boards and of several diverse organizations and also consults and advises with many. He's written several books, his latest having been published in February this year. The title of that book is Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy. And I thought this quote from the inside of the book is quite provocative and poignant. Richard Norgaard, professor of energy and resources, UC Berkeley, said that bearing witness to a right relationship between people and nature, Brown and Garber, the co-author, provide better advice for an ecologically sustainable and socially just economy than all the Nobel laureates in economics combined. Peter is also involved in tree farming and conservation efforts in Maryland, Maine, and Quebec. He is a certified Quebec forest producer. His farm in Maryland is enrolled in the Forest Stewardship Program, as well as the Maryland Agricultural Land Preservation Program. At the appointment of the governor of Maryland, he also served as the first chair of the Rural Legacy Advisory Committee. Will you please join me in welcoming Peter Brown?
Thank you very much for the generous introduction. And I'd like to acknowledge that two of my co-authors are here in the room. Jeff Garber is right here in the second row, and Keith Helmuth over there in the third row. Without the support of a Quaker Institute for the Future, which has some other representatives here, this book wouldn't have happened. It's a book that grows very much out of a Quaker perspective, but it's by no means a Quaker book, right? I think it's informed and inspired by a Quaker perspective, but I think it has wide appeal. One of the there's a formidable task in front of me that I hadn't anticipated, which is that you all have had some wine, right? And so, I know I'm going to have to be a little more active than usual. And so one of the things I'm going to lay down toward the end of my talk is, well, just to keep you anticipating, is there's a picture of eternal life at the end of my talk, right? And you hardly ever get a picture of that, right? And the second thing is, it's really important that we learn to be a little more obnoxious than we already are, right? So I'm going to talk a little bit about that at the end of the talk, too. I'm going to take for granted that everybody knows and is aware of the ecological crisis that we're in, that the declining biodiversity, acidification of the oceans, loss of topsoil, climate change, et cetera, right? There's no point in going over that list anymore. And the reason we wrote this book was really an attempt to try to rethink economics in a way that would lead us away from the path we're on toward a more fruitful path. And what I'm going to do this evening is to talk about both the need to rethink economics, but I'm going to place that in a broader sort of historical context and try to show that there's sort of very deep trends in our society that have led us to a pretty unfortunate circumstance. One of the key concepts in the book is in the title of the book, Right Relationship. And right relationship is a term that's in many of the world's religions and is also a common sense word. You can have a right relationship with your husband or wife. Right? I've been divorced twice, so I know that you can have a right and a wrong relationship. Right, and you can have a right relationship with your club, with a radio station, with your university, and you can have a right or wrong relationship with the earth. And a right relationship is what we have here on the screen now. It's a thing is right when it preserves the integrity, resilience, and beauty of the commonwealth of life. Right, so you can have a right relationship with the earth if the earth is flourishing and you're flourishing. You're in right relationship with the earth. Now, one of the ways to grasp a concept like this is to look at the opposite of it. And so I've got a picture of that here. Wrong relationship is when you're not in a flourishing relationship with where the two parties interact in such a way that they're both degraded. And this is an example of that's going on now in Alberta, Canada. This is the infamous tar sands project, which is not only destroying the landscape, as you can see in this photograph, but is also an extremely inefficient way to get fossil fuels, right, which does lots of collateral ecological damage, but also contributes very significantly to Canadian greenhouse gas emissions. So this is really an example of how not to do it. Here's a more global example of wrong relationship. This is a photograph of the Arctic ice cap in 2005. I looked at some with the yellow line in the picture is the line of where the Arctic ice was in September 21st, I think, 1979, and that's the 2005 September 21st distribution. 2007 was much worse than that. 2008 there was a slight bounce back in terms of total coverage. But the ice is over the long-term trend in the thickness of the ice is definitely down. Now, it doesn't really matter in some ways if this ice melts because it's already floating in the ocean, right? So it won't really cause sea level to rise that much if you melt just the Arctic ice cap. But what it will do is it will change the heat reflective capacity of the northern hemisphere of the Earth and will cause a substantial warming of the northern hemisphere, and will accelerate the melting of the Greenland ice sheet. I asked a friend of mine at McGill, Lawrence Mizak, who's a specialist on long-term climate, what it would take to melt all the natural ice on Earth, and he said, well, get to 700 or 800 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, stay there for a century or so, and you'll melt it all, and if you melt it all, you get 260 feet vertical sea level rise. So this is the path we're on, right? We have no policies in place that would avoid this consequence, although it would take several centuries to get to that dire outcome. James Hansen, who is a chief scientist at NASA, has predicted 15-foot sea level rise by 2107. So if you're living in the lower parts of Texas or other places like that, you know, you'll be the last generation to live there unless you want to spend a lot of your money on dikes. And things like that. So this is really an example of humanity being in wrong relationship to the Earth. And I just wanted to sort of dramatize this a little bit. This is Reverend Jones from Indiana, who commanded that his parishioners go to South America. Once they were there, he ordered them all to kill themselves. Large numbers of them did. Right, this is a picture of Jonestown, Guyana, right after his proclamation. And this is where I took the title for this talk for purposes of the club, right? That we are on basically an ecocide path, right? We are destroying the complexity of the Earth's ecological systems and its life support capacity at an accelerating rate. And one of the main players in that is the world economic system, and I'm going to talk quite a bit about that in a few minutes. So one thing we need to do is to change the question, right? How can we get from the idea that the Earth is here as an object for our exploitation to the idea that the Earth should be an object of love, affection, and respect, as one would respect one's home or something like that? I was very pleased to see in the New York Times this morning that the Pope had called for a complete reexamination of the world economy, but I was quite worried to see that he still regards the world as an object only for human use and not as something to be venerated in its own right. So it's a good step forward. And what I think we need to do as a culture is to really rethink a lot of what we're doing, rethink citizenship, the economy, our personal role in bringing about dramatic change. And I think that there's a phrase from Thomas Berry that I've used a couple of places in this talk, could this be a moment of grace, right? Thomas Berry, as you know, died about 2 weeks ago now and was very much, wrote a really terrific book called The Great Work about rethinking the human-Earth relationship to become a flourishing, mutually enhancing relationship or a right relationship. So I only want to make sort of four main points. I want to talk a little bit about how we got on the wrong path, how to re-envision who we are to get on a more promising path, what this all has to do with economics and the macroeconomic system, and then things we can do as individuals to help get there. So I've been very influenced by Albert Schweitzer in my thinking about these problems over the last several years, particularly his book, The Philosophy of Civilization, book completed in 1923 or thereabouts. And one of the things that Schweitzer says very dramatically in that book is that the Western tradition really got off on the wrong foot right in the from the beginning, because it concentrated on the question, what's good for humanity, as opposed to the question, what's good for life, right? And so there's a separation between us and other life forms and us and the Earth built into the very foundations of our culture. And I think, explain this in the question period, I think this is true both of the religious or Judeo-Christian sources of our culture and the sources that come from Plato and Aristotle. A second problem is we have too narrow a conception of morality. Right? In the New Testament story of the Good Samaritan, Jesus is asked the question, what do I have to do, Master, to secure eternal life? And his answer is to obey the two commandments, including, of course, love your neighbor as yourself. And it turns out that the neighbor is another person. We don't naturally extend the moral universe to non-persons in our culture. Some individuals do, there are some groups that do, and so forth. But if you look at the industrial animal farming in North American culture, you can see, right, that they are not regarded as objects of morality. They're regarded as objects of utility only. I read a book when I first got to McGill on pig production, just to see if there's anything in there about the well-being of the pig, right? And there wasn't. So further things that got on the wrong path to begin with, and then things that made it even worse were the rise of what's called Baconian science, the notion that the goal of science is to increase the human power over the Earth as opposed to human understanding of the Earth, which was Aristotle's objective. And then in Descartes and other people in the Enlightenment, the idea was widely promulgated that it was only humans that think, right, that other animals and plants can't think. And I'll give an example in a little later on how plants think. It's quite a wrong move. And then what's happened to us in this period is that there's been many scientific discoveries over the last several hundred years, but there's been very little rapprochement or integration of our scientific understandings with our moral understandings. Right? They pretty much have kept on separate tracks. And I don't know how many people have seen the movie The Magic Christian, but there's a great scene in this movie where Peter Sellers is the richest man in the world. He has a board meeting going on in a train, and he's talking about the prospects of his company, which are all negative. Sales are down, public confidence is down, and so forth. So he says, well, gentlemen, you're all fired. And train stops, and they get off, and he hands each of them a map, right? They're somewhere in, I don't know, looks like Yorkshire or someplace like that. And but they're not maps of where they are, right? They're sort of maps of, you know, Australia and, you know, a map of northern Norway, right? Map of Paris, right? But no map of Yorkshire, right? Well, that's where we are, basically, right, as a culture, right? Because we, the constructs that we use to guide ourselves in the world are not constructs about built on a scientific understanding of reality. We're lost. Okay, so how, and this is obviously a lot of big questions here, so I just wanted to sketch a few of the things that I think we need to do to get in right relationship, to get reoriented in our thinking, and then show what these would all mean for economics. And there are really five things I want to mention here. One is that we're part of a vast creative process, not a created process, but a creative process. That process has led to the evolution of life on the Earth, perhaps unique in the universe. We simply don't know the answer to that. That we as humans have a special obligation or a special nobility in terms of our particular place on the Earth. We need to rethink citizenship, and then we need to recognize our role in the commonwealth of life. So I just want to talk briefly about each of those. This is a picture from the Hubble Space Telescope. This is a rather well-known picture now called the Pillars of Creation. And this is an enormous space. And this is basically a star factory. These pillars are bombarded by ultraviolet rays. They give birth to suns or to things like the sun. Some of them don't succeed in making it to the status of a sun, but many do. And what we know now about the creative processes of the universe is that approximately 13.8 billion years ago, there was the Big Bang. Whether that's the beginning of the universe, we don't know. But that there's been a process of continuous evolution of the universe since then, and biological evolution, which obviously was well thought through, or the beginning of Darwin started to think that through. A lot's happened since then, of course, is a special case of cosmic evolution, right? The whole universe is an evolutionary process, and I think it's reasonable to say that the universe itself learns, right? As new things happen, the universe adapts its behavior. And so the story of which we're a part, in which Thomas Berry talks, is that we're part of a creative process, not a created process, right? That the process of creation is underway now. We're on this very small thing in a very, very, very big place. This is a picture from 1987 from Voyager, and the two little dots on the picture, there are two little bars on the picture, are just to show you where the Earth is, right? Just to show you how very, very small it is. And this is what Carl Sagan had to say about that picture several years later, just really emphasizing the tininess of the Earth and the sort of fragility of the life on it and the possible uniqueness of that life. And what I think and what we argued in the books is that we need to rethink our relationship with this planet, which you can hardly see here, in terms of some ideas from Aldo Leopold, the famous conservation writer from the 1940s. And here's his quote, that it's not exactly the same one we used on the cover of the book, but I think it speaks to our condition right now, that we have the challenge of living on this Earth but not destroying it, right, and not degrading it, but helping it to flourish as we ourselves want to flourish. So one of the things we need to rethink is the concept of citizenship. And if you made a list of the mistakes that we made in the 20th century as a culture, allowing the substitution of the word consumer for the word citizenship was a big one, right? Because it allowed us to think of ourselves as just what do I want, as opposed to how do I fit into the community, how can I provide leadership to the community, and how can I help the community to sustain itself. And this is a tricky concept, but I found it very illuminated by a very short book by James Karsh called Finite and Infinite Games, which basically it makes a distinction between finite games like football or baseball or hockey, things like that, where there's a set game. It's a particular place. There's a field or a rink or something. There's a referee. There's set rules, set number of players, set expectations, and the goal is to win. He says, okay, that's all fine, but there are also infinite games where the purpose of the game is to keep the game going. Right? That's civilization. Right? That's why things like the Commonwealth Club exists, right? Because we want somehow or other this state of affairs, of which we are a finite and mortal part, to keep going. In an infinite game, the weaker player is aided by the stronger. Right? New players can be added. Players can be taken off out of the game. The referee can join the game, and the rules can be changed as you go along. Right? And what I think a good way to think about citizenship is as being a player in an infinite game, where you're trying to keep the game going. Right? Now, if you think about the universe in the way I've been describing in the last few minutes, sort of the ultimate infinite game, the game that goes on forever, hopefully, is evolution, right? Is cosmic and biological evolution. And the role of citizen, if you're looking at it sort of through a Leopold lens, is to keep this game going. And what we're doing at this point is snuffing this game out, right? We're basically reducing biological evolution. And the last point is, I think we need to get rid of the exalted conception of ourselves built into some of our religious heritage, right? We are not made in the image of God, and the world was not given by God to us, right? We co-evolved with the earth and with the other life forms on it. So I redrew this picture, believe it or not. Let's talk about hubris. There's mine, right? And so it's not nearly as beautiful as Michelangelo's, but it's truer, right? And I can't help that, right? So anybody wants to give me a better version of this, I'd be glad to have it. So what's this all got to do with the economy? I think a lot. And the present economic system is one of the great villains in the unraveling of Earth's life support prospects. So I want to talk about that. And in the book, we asked what we think are five very simple questions about the economy. What's it for? How does it work? How big is too big? What's fair? And how should it be governed? And so the principle, spend most of the next 10 or 15 minutes talking about answers to those questions. The background for this picture taken, I think maybe by Jeff, on part of my farm in southern Quebec. It's a part I call the cathedral for obvious reasons, right? Because kind of it closes at the top. Okay, what's the economy for? Well, if you look at this kind of standard textbook, it's for growth, right? It's for full employment, increased material prosperity through economic growth as measured by GMP. Economists have done a lot of work on why the GMP measure is not a very promising measure, why it isn't something that we should want, but it continues to be used as the principal measure of economic health and progress, and it's very, very distorting for a variety of reasons. We propose I'm going to come back to that in the question period. We propose another answer to this question, going back, ironically, to John Maynard Keynes, who was the father of macroeconomics, right? Who really thought up the field of macroeconomics. And what Keynes was concerned with, in my reading of Keynes, was to head off World War II. He was a member of the British delegation to the Versailles Conference. And he left the conference sort of in a huff. He said, if you impose the conditions of the Versailles Treaty on the Germans, it will bring about economic decline of Germany, will bring about large-scale unemployment, the rise of a dictator, and another war. He made that prediction in 1919. And in, as you know, 1939, the war got underway. And Keynes attributed a lot of that to bad economic management, to poor large amount of unemployment, and to inability to stimulate enough demand to keep people working, basically. So what he wanted to achieve with macroeconomics was social stability, right? So that you wouldn't have frequent devastating wars, which was right after World War I, obviously very much on everybody's mind. But what he left out for very complicated historical reasons was the world, right? Right. We think it's a very simple adjustment in that idea, which is to say, okay, well, we do want stability or at least resilience, right? Stability, maybe we can't get that, but we want to have flourishing human and natural communities, right? We don't want to be murdered, or we don't want to have to go to war, and we don't want to have our homes blasted away by hurricanes or massive floods, right? These are perfectly reasonable goals, but they are not recognized by the current economic system as reasonable goals to be achieved. So this very simple idea draws on the insights of many of the world's traditional peoples and on some insights from our own culture, although for reasons I mentioned earlier, they're not emphasized there. So here's a picture, right, of what the economy's for, right? It's for a flourishing earth, right? For flourishing humans, right? For beautiful, fecund, lovely earth, right? And so we don't think that's a complicated idea. It just isn't the idea that we're pursuing. Now, how could that possibly be? Right? It seems so obvious as to be painful. Well, one of the problems is that economics does not recognize that it's part of the universe and that it is subject to the laws of physics, chemistry, and biology. So we have this picture here to point out, right, that, well, you're part of the universe and you have to conceive of economics in terms of what we know about how the universe works. So this seems like a fantastic claim. So I brought one of my favorite books. This is a book by Andrew Abel, Benjamin Bernanke, and Ben Krushor, I guess his name is pronounced, Macroeconomics. This was used in my son's class at Columbia Business School. And he finished with it, I said, would you give it to me? For obvious reasons, I didn't want to buy one. What is amazing about this book is that if you look up climate change, biodiversity loss, any of the sort of things that we're worried about, there's no entry. Right? If you look up the leaders in the field of ecological economics, Herman Daly, Robert Costanza, Georgescu Rogan, they're not mentioned. So there's one page in this book where the relationship between the economy and the environment is discussed. It's in a green box, believe it or not, page 30. And it says that the economic indicators don't do a very good job of relating the economy to nature, to the environment. And then the other 585 pages of this book use those indicators. Okay, so this is a system that is really run amok, right? Because there's been no significant systematic rapprochement between mainstream economics and science since the year 1800. So you may think that couldn't possibly be right, right? Write me an email, right? I can make that stick. Right? So this is a bunch of folks that are in charge of our arrangements who don't know where they are. Okay, so if you think about things this way, what's the basic unit of wealth? It isn't paper money, it isn't account balances, it isn't your credit card limit, all that kind of stuff. It's photosynthesis, it's the ability of the earth to support complex life like the people in this room, like the Commonwealth Club, like San Francisco, like the state of California, and et cetera. And it used to be a bumper sticker around, have you thanked a green plant today? And I don't see that much anymore, but if you haven't, you should, because if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't be here, basically, right? So they're the basic thing that makes it all, makes the whole thing work. But in conventional macroeconomics, there's no conceptual relationship between that process and economic process. So if you think that way, then you have to begin to rethink some of the standard words we use to describe what goes on in the economy. And one of those is the idea of money. Money is the right we give to ourselves in society to intervene in the Earth's life support processes, right? Every time you spend money, you have a thermodynamic effect on the Earth, right? Every time you take a trip, every time you go to the grocery store, right? Every time you flush the toilet, right? All of these things have consequences. And in general, rich people do more of those things, right? We take longer trips, have bigger multiple cars, and so forth and so on. And so they are able to interact more and do and have more effect on the Earth's life support systems. In other words, they exert a larger ecological footprint. Maybe the other of these four ideas here, I'll just mention the last one, a budget. So the Earth basically has a finite capacity to support complex systems. This is called various things, but it's principles often called net primary productivity. How much of the energy that flows into a green plant and is converted into food of some sort is used by the plant. You subtract that part out, and then how much is left over? That's the surplus, right? That's called net primary productivity, and that's really what that's what the planet's got to work with. So on one side of the equation, it's how much net primary productivity is there that's generated by plants and sunlight. And on the other side of the equation is how much of the byproducts of economic activity can be absorbed by the Earth and be degraded in a benign fashion. What climate change is the inability of the Earth to absorb or reabsorb all of the carbon that we're pumping into the atmosphere. So how big is too big? Question never asked in macroeconomics, except if there's inflation. Right? The idea that economic growth could be net not beneficial does not arise within this discipline. It's asked very pointedly by Herman Daly, is there a time at which, a circumstance at which, it could be the case that economic growth does more harm than good? That question can find no footing in books like this one. So we give, a very simple answer to this. Economy is too big when it overwhelms the Earth's life support systems, both on the building up of the complexity side of the system and on the assimilation of waste. So the economy is already too big, right, because these systems are breaking down. But the object of every single government in the world, or almost every single government, there may be one or two small places I haven't heard about, is to stimulate more of what we're already doing, not less of what we're already doing. And one of the tragic wastes of the current absolute avalanche of cash that's flying around is that the ecological crisis, which is long and big and mean compared to the present crisis, those two crises haven't been connected, right? We haven't used the stimulus packages, the opportunity we have to move the economy in a dramatically different direction. What's fair? Well, fairness is normally thought of, this goes back really to Schweitzer's point about the Western tradition getting off on the wrong foot. Fairness is normally thought to be about something between people. But that can't possibly be right, because unless you think other living things have no claim whatsoever on the ability of the Earth to support life. So fairness has to be rethought to include not only fairness between people, which the world's very unfair now with regard to that, but between people of this generation and future generations, and also between people and other species. It's how much of a place in the sun do we get, and how much of a place in the sun do they get? And right now, we're using up about half of the world's net primary productivity. And we're one out of about 15 or 20 million species. So it seems like it might be just a little bit overreaching, right, to take half, right, of that. So there's also, and I come back to this maybe in the question period, but it's also you can see now that some of our other concepts are very problematical. When Prime Minister Harper goes to China, then people write to him and they say, well, you got to bring up human rights. Scold the Chinese about human rights, right? And when Obama goes to Russia, he's supposed to scold the Russians about human rights. Well, okay, they need a scolding. It's fine if they do it. It's great. I'm glad. But what they don't take on board is that the human rights violators par excellence are us, right? Right? We, every morning during the week, right, there's a traffic jam in Montreal. In every North American city, there's one. It's regarded as inconvenient, right? But it isn't pointed out that it's killing people in other parts of the world. That's an unpleasant truth about what we do. Right? So we're big human rights violators. They're human rights violators too, but you know, we can't really wear the cloth of virtue on this. So the last question I want to talk about is how to govern it. And we don't really have very well worked out conceptual tools to how to think about this. And in the book, we suggest what some of those are. And we're really in an era where the role of national governments has to be changed pretty dramatically. We're in a way in a post-national world here, and we need to really wake up to that and try to think systematically about what to do. So one thing we could do is we could leave governance to the people who are already governing, right? This is... stay around the microphone, sorry. He's the head of the Bank of Canada. I like that picture of him because it looks like he's praying. That's Ben Bernanke. Everybody knows that. And then this is Merwin King, who's head of the Bank of England. So Maclean's Magazine, which is the Time Magazine of Canada, had a cover 3 or 4 years ago. It had the picture of the president of Iran on the cover. And underneath it said, the most dangerous man on earth. And I thought, well, that's just obviously absurd, right? Because in my view, I mean, not everybody in the room shares this. I thought that might be somebody who lived in the White House. Then I thought, well, no, it's really not him either, right? Because the most dangerous man on earth by far, right, it looked at from the perspective of this lecture, not saying he's a bad person at an individual level, is Mr. Bernanke, right? Because he believes in infinite growth in a finite system. And what makes him even more dangerous is nobody realizes he's dangerous, right? Right. So, you know, we really have to think hard about who we've turned the power over to for the future governance of this planet. So I'm going to just catch a few of these items, and then I'll conclude. The national government system doesn't really work that well right now because of issues of velocity and scale. When the United States was formed as a country, when Canada was formed and so forth, the environmental problems weren't happening fast and they weren't big. But now they're both fast and big. Many nations of the world are capped, going to the third reason here, many nations of the world are captured by their own elites, right? And they don't act in the public interest, right? And international governance doesn't work that well either. One of the main shortcomings of the international governmental system is that there's no means to assure fairness. Right? We have radical poverty in the world and oceans of money, and we're not able in any systematic way to alleviate that radical poverty, and we suggest in our book some ways that might be done. And there are also power imbalances in the international system that are very regrettable. The UN permanent members are Security Council are United States, Britain, France, China, and Russia, right? Winners of World War II in a way. The major arms exporters in the world are, right, United States, France, Britain, Russia, and China, right? I said the same names both times. So I think it should be renamed the Insecurity Council, right? So these nations have far too much power and apply that within an unjust way often. So we suggest some exits from this system. One is an institution for of democratic federalism, modeled in part after the European Union model, but with the neoclassical economics feature of that model surgically removed. We suggest some trust to protect the global commons like the ocean and the atmosphere. We suggest an Earth Reserve Bank, to use formula, IPAT formula, which I'll come back to in a minute. And we suggest strengthening and making mandatory the World Court. So just some images of these things, the global federalism, that's the image of the European Union, obviously. It's a very thoughtful book by somebody who lives in this area, Peter Barnes, followed by a book called Capitalism 3.0. And what he suggests in this book is a setting up of a trustee arrangement for use of the right to dispose of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And this, I think, is a generalizable idea that could be done both for the United States and could be done globally, and could also be done for the use of the world's oceans. Would generate revenue and would also generate limits on what could be done to these commons. We also suggest the creation of an Earth Reserve, something somewhat like the Federal Reserve system. The Federal Reserve tries to control the economy through interest rates and the money supply. But what we need to do is calculate how the Earth works and then try to regulate the economy so that the economy functions within the biophysical limits of the Earth. And then we need to set limits based on good morals. We propose, obviously, right relationship as a moral standard and good science, and then try to live within those limits. And we suggest using, and I'll come back to this in the question period, a formula by John Holdren and Paul Ehrlich, both Californians, the IPAT formula. I stands for impact, and then P stands for population, A stands for affluence, T stands for technology, and E, which we added, it wasn't part of the original formula, stands for ethics or conduct. And those are basically the PATE are basically the theaters or the possibilities that we have to head off disaster, right? To the human population is by any reasonable measure too large. Large numbers of people in the world by any reasonable measure are too rich. The bet for the planet is on things like carbon capture and storage, right? It's all on the technology variable. That's a very problematical technology. We're urged by our government to buy more, not less. That's the ethical command of our era, right, is to consume more. Here's an image from Bob Costanza of what this might look like. The basic idea here is just to think of the world in terms of its biophysical processes. It absorbs energy from the sun, obviously. It uses that energy to run the planet, basically, and then it dissipates degraded energy back into space, and we need to be able to think of the Earth in terms of these fundamental operating principles. And then the last suggestion is the strengthened world court. So what can we do to try to make some of these changes? This is the very last section, not very long. One is we need to, it also has the picture of eternal life, though, right? So hang in there. So one of the things we did was to think about, this is very much available within the Quaker tradition, to think about what people who have tried to make substantial social change have done. So if you look at Nelson Mandela, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, people like that, you know, they go through, there's an identifiable set of processes there. I think one of them is called grounding and clarification, or you know, basically going, examining yourself, going back to your sort of own inner strengths and convictions, and finding, you know, the resolve and the will and the courage, basically, to take on very massive social change. I think each of these people and many others have done this. Second thing you need to do is design your what you want, right? To figure out what would make a radically better situation. And then you need to try to achieve some sort of bring everybody else along, right? That's in part happening in this era with regard to these problems. And then within our tradition, we advocate nonviolent reform or nonviolent direct action and nonviolent civil disobedience, right? And it's my view, and maybe not shared by all the co-authors, that things like this are almost certain to have to happen, right? Because, you know, we are up against very, very powerful forces which are not making a lot of progress. This was an image used by Quakers in the early part of the 19th century to when they were working on abolishing slavery. It's a drawing of a slave ship used to transport slaves from Africa to North America. And it shows how crowded it was on those ships. Many people died under those circumstances, you can imagine. And the British public basically said, well, this is not acceptable to a Christian nation. It's not acceptable to British morals to condone this. And so in about 1813, Britain outlawed the slave trade and enforced that with the British Navy, which was the controlling naval power at the time. So that was a big step forward for human dignity. So we don't want our legacy to be this, right? There's large numbers of refugees. That's where we're headed, right? Large numbers of people who are going to have to move or die. A lot of people will die. And if we don't get on a different track, you know, those numbers will be not in the tens of millions, which I think is now inevitable, but be in the hundreds of millions. And that, I don't think reasonable people of conscience want that to be our legacy. So can this be our moment of grace? Go back to Thomas Berry's question. Can there be a kind of internal redirection of ourselves? And my argument, at least, is we have to understand ourselves as elements in a vast process of evolution and expansion and knowledge. And one of the things I promise to say is how it is that trees think, right? Since I'm a tree farmer, I thought quite a bit about this. So if you, and I've also had this experience, if you have a septic tank and you plant a maple tree near your septic tank, it will send its roots over to the nutrients, right, near your septic tank. So if you define intelligence as the ability to change your behavior on the basis of new information, trees can think, right? Right? So thinking is not something exclusive to us, right? Thinking is all over the place. It's just different kinds of thinking. Right, so I have some friends, you know, I have a friend at University of Maryland, trained in physics, trained at Berkeley, by the way, who to amuse himself used to calculate whether if the plane door opened at 35,000 feet, whether he would freeze to death or die by hitting the ground, which would come first. The answer is you'd freeze to death before you hit the ground, I think. So he was amused, right, by sort of mental exercises like that. Now, I don't do those kind of things, right, but that's one kind of learning, right? But the tree is learning too, right, and squirrels are learning, right? There's learning all around, right? And we just have to wake up to it. So we need to move, we need to get rid of the idea we're consumers. We have to insist that the government treat us as adults. We need to get economics completely revised, get it connected to ethics, get it connected to science, right? One of the other alarming things about this book is where these people were educated. They were educated at what are regarded as some of the best universities in the world. So the challenge is great. We have to make a big change, but we've done it before. And we just need to do it now. And we have to get ourselves into a state of mind, as characterized by Thomas Berry in this quote, where we regard the universe as composed of subjects with which we can commune, not as objects which we use. Right? And we have to stop thinking about the Earth primarily in terms of what we can get from it, and more in terms of something to be loved, respected, and cared for. Otherwise, the Earth's going to stay here, but life on the Earth will decline markedly, and so will we. So there's my picture of eternal life. This is a black spruce up in the James Bay region of Quebec. and there's a little tree growing out of the stump of a big tree, if you can see that, right? So this is the process that goes on in on Earth, right, of eternal, perpetual, at least, if you don't like eternal, perpetual regeneration. And our job is to keep that process going. Thank you for listening.
I want to remind our audience here at the Commonwealth Club that we're listening to Peter Brown, professor at McGill University in Montreal, Canada, who's talking to us about the economics of ecocide and how we can build a whole earth economy. So we'll move into a period of question and answer. So if you have some questions, I urge you to please raise your hand. I'm going to lead off, if I may, with a question. Such tremendous insights you've shared with us here on a very broad, comprehensive basis, and it seems to me this overwhelming challenge is how do we individually and collectively change our behavior, change how we think and act. And I was curious about your belief or faith in mankind's ability to get it, that is, with perhaps the persistence of education, that is, building the kind of awareness that you've contributed to here in this room this evening, in terms of just holding some of this stuff up to the light for us and so forth. Is that education factor and the building of awareness, increased awareness on the part of all of us humans, is that going to be sufficient or just a necessary part?
Well, certainly not both necessary and sufficient, right? It's one of the reasons that I use a quote from Thomas Berry so much is that it's not just a question of getting the facts right, because we know a lot of the facts, right? The issues like climate change and biodiversity loss are very, very well studied, and they've been studied well for quite a long time. And, you know, they've had the knowledge that we have about those things has had very little impact on what we actually do. So it requires an internal transformation in addition to that. It's not to say that the scientific information isn't essential, but one of the reasons that we wrote this book the way we did is and one of the reasons I was very pleased to see what the Pope had said, even though I don't completely agree with it, is this is a process which requires both education, as that's normally understood, but an internal moral and spiritual transformation. If we're going to make it, and one of the encouraging things about that is, when large numbers of people are able to make that transformation, you can get change quite fast, right? If you one of the real success stories in American life, I think, is Mothers Against Drunk Driving, right? That was just people just said, well, look, we're just not going to put up with this. This is an absolute outrage, and that was a change. I mean, obviously, a lot of bad stuff still happens. I'm not saying that. But in terms of the change in the law, the change in public attitude toward that behavior, it was dramatic and brought about by very courageous people. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to find those people, work with them. And somebody that's out there, I think, is a very important player in the next few months, Bill McKibben, on climate change. And his website, I think, is 350.org. That's, I think, there is all there is to it. If you believe James Hansen's predictions about climate change, the threshold of danger has already been passed, and passed by quite a bit. So if we're going to head off a disaster, we have to not only reduce emissions, we have to reduce concentrations. We have to get lower what's already out there. And McKibben is a very energetic. I've seen some pictures of him recently. He looks sort of worn out, right? But he's a very energetic, very dedicated man, a very, very much a leader, moral leader on this thing now.
If I may just drill down a little bit and return to the initial question, it almost appears to me that in a way, this is a marketing challenge. That is, when I think of marketing, I'm thinking of it in this way. That is, that we're trying to communicate with people in ways that are important and relevant to them as citizens of the earth. So it's not just a matter just of the talking points per se, but yet, you know, the continual sharpening of those marketing talking right. points, but also the persistence. And then I think bringing from the own experience of the Quaker, read stories, and I forget the name of the gentleman that finally persisted over several years of traveling around talking about abolishing slavery, and I'm sure the...
John Woolman.
There we go. And so the combination of sharpening the talking points, the persistence, making it important and relevant to all of us as citizens of the earth. I don't know. It seems to go beyond education, and I don't mean to belabor the point, but if you had any follow-on comments, otherwise we'll move on to the next question.
Well, I think if I gather you work in the marketing field, so maybe you can help us.
Yes. Until we as a culture can get our arms around tax policy and get our arms around corporate personhood and reset the entire fabric of investment banking, none of this will happen. For example, there's $900 trillion of cash flow in this culture that is not taxed. $900 trillion. Corporations are just, they're the feudal system of the modern day era. They are with, and the question is, until we address those three issues, this won't go anywhere. Your comments.
I agree completely. I mean, this is a radical rethink is needed. Gus Speth's book, Bridge at the Edge of the World, is a terrific book on this question. And I've been in touch with people in the who are very senior in the financial community, understand finance 100 times better than I do. Well, I know David, not the person I'm thinking of at this point, but and I think there are people who have worked in some of the major financial houses in the United States who've come to the same conclusion that you have, that this system is really out of control, really needs to be rethought, and so we're trying to make common cause with those people. I take your point 100%. Corporate personhood, too, right? It's a ridiculous idea, basically, and needs to be gotten rid of.
Sir, I have my background is in systems in my entire career, and I'm recently, in the last year, have studied the area of energy, and in particular, the reduction of CO2. And the dichotomy that I face here is that my research shows that the only form of terrestrial energy, not sun energy, the terrestrial energy is nuclear fission and nuclear power, nuclear fusion. That's it. And it also turns out that the only way to significantly reduce the 81% of the power generation CO2 emissions from coal is to substitute those over time with nuclear power. My question is this, that I would put out the proposition, I'd like your comments, that the reason that there is so much resistance to recognize and do something about global warming may not be entirely because people don't believe it, but knowing that Denmark has barely reduced its CO2 emissions with wind, solar has a small effect, knowing that, people don't think that there's a feasible solution being proposed by those who identify the problem.
Right.
And I'd like your comments on that.
Yeah. Well, I think I attended a conference in the UK just about 2 weeks ago on solar energy, and one of the things the conference lacked was a real critic of what they were saying. But their argument was, it was several people who work in the solar field, was that you could generate all the electricity needed in the world by something a relatively small percentage of Libya or someplace like that. Well, and they had our answers to all of that. I mean,
they don't have client answers.
Yeah,
but not in charge of balancing the input and output.
Yeah. So it's to me nuclear fusion, which I think we don't have basically, right? So it's only nuclear fission we can talk about. It would be an act of last resort, but it's a better thing to do than to let climate change run away. A red herring on nuclear fission is the waste disposal problem. I think the waste disposal problem is reasonably tractable. The waste disposal problem on coal-fired power is not tractable, right?
It sounds to me from what you're saying that you really need to redefine what civilization is, because in your reference to indigenous cultures that have this model of respect for the world, and its interrelationship, they're not what we consider civilized.
Right.
And so how do you reconcile that? I mean, your model suggests, you know, tearing up roadways and restoring the earth under them. And that sort of is not what we consider to be civilized.
Yeah, I wrote an essay recently called An Ethics of Compassionate Retreat. Uh-huh. Right, what we've gotten way out, we push things too far in many ways, right? And we need to step back in some sort of orderly way from the huge impact we're having on the planet. And the IPAT formula, I think, gives some clues as to how to work on that. The gentleman that spoke about nuclear power, we have to look at the technology sector, obviously, but we also have to look at reducing the absurd level of wealth, right, through progressive tax, basically, through regulation of financial industries, things like that. And we have to look at reducing the human population in an orderly way. That's not draconian. In Quebec, you know, the birth rate per woman is 1.5 births per woman, right? It's nothing in the least bit illiberal or forced or anything about that, right? We know how to do these things. We just don't do them.
My question goes back to the fascinating parallel you drew between the kind of change of thinking that's clearly required and the change of thinking that drove the abolition of the slave trade in the early 19th century. And mm-hmm. you didn't say, but we might add, the actual abolition of slavery itself a generation later in the 19th century.
Still here, but it's much diminished.
Yes, yeah. But in its classical form at least. Right. The question I was going to put to you is this. It seems to me that that's not the only example of huge changes of heart driving enormous changes of society in a beneficent direction. There were others, mostly in the 19th century. In the early 19th century, the casual use of the death penalty for trivial crimes was the norm throughout the world. Mm-hmm. And meant very often public executions. Everyone thought it was normal. Mm-hmm. Just like many people in the U.S. still think the death penalty is normal. But it was commonplace for the most trivial offenses. And yet the whole society had a change of heart and came to see that it was wrong. It was common to send ships to sea with the expectation that many of them would sink until Samuel Plimsoll, another spiritually driven businessman with a conscience, spent a lifetime struggling against the common practice of sending ships to sea in the sure knowledge that a sizable proportion of them would sink. Mm-hmm. And the Plimsoll line came to paint.
So I'm encouraged by all this, but what's the question?
My question is, how do we learn from those experiences? Because they show it can be done, don't you think?
Well, I hadn't thought of Plimsoll and some of the other ones. And you know, one obvious thing would be to study those examples and see what happened. We studied these more highly visible ones in the writing of the book, but you know, other things about like ship safety, bridge safety, things like that, right? Those are important innovations. So let's look at the models of social change that have worked. The problem we have is that you know we may be in a situation where we're already passing certain thresholds, right? So we have to move rapidly and decisively in working on those examples and mobilizing people.
I want to remind our audience we're listening to Peter Brown, who's a professor at McGill University in Montreal, Canada, talking to us about building a whole earth economy. We've got time for maybe a couple more questions.
I hear a lot out of India and China, and I was in working in a developing country in Southeast Asia, that they know this. They know about climate change. They know this is happening. But the comment is, we need to get where you are at. So we're going to do it the same way. I'd like you to talk a little bit about, are there any movements to help change that in especially Asia, where we see this Southeast and South Asia, where we see this happening?
Well, the ideology of growth is really virtually everywhere, including those two countries. India will, several of the major rivers for India and China are fed by the Himalayan glaciers. Those glaciologists from that region predict those glaciers will be gone by 2030, so that's virtually now. Those rivers will not dry up entirely, but their flow will be different and in key parts of the year a lot less. So their disaster is coming on them in some way. And also the low-lying parts of those countries are going to be flooded, have saline penetration of their water supplies, things like that. So what we suggest in the book is that we need to not accomplish addressing poverty through growth, but through redistribution. Right? And so if you're going to use. So I have a farm near Quebec. It's in a beautiful apple-growing region. Right? In the fall, when the apples are harvested, you can buy apples from New Zealand at approximately the same price in the same markets, right? And you can see virtually the fields or the orchards where the Canadian apples are grown. We need to tax the use of the commons, right, and then share the revenues, right, with people who are impoverished. One of the many defects of the current economic system is it has no principle of fairness in it at all, just none. It's not there. So anyway, I haven't said a single good thing about it so far, and my mother said, if you don't have something nice to say, don't say anything at all, right? But I certainly violated that rule, right?
This may be restating the question, but are these ideas at all compatible with capitalism, or is it necessarily in conflict with the capitalist model?
Certainly it would have to be a radically revised and constrained capitalism. You can't have the corporation as a person. You can't have you can't have growth all the time, right? And one of the things that Marx was right about is capitalism, you know, tends to want to expand into other markets all the time because it wants to find other profit-making opportunities. And you know that's been one of the factors. Trade has been one of the factors. Not all bad, but trade has been one of the factors that led to a lot of biodiversity loss, for instance, right, through chopping down of forests in Malaysia and Brazil, places like that. So we have to think about, I don't know, I'm not ready to conclude that capitalism has to get thrown out the window, but I am ready to conclude that it has to be very constrained, and it has to be rethought from an Earth's perspective in as opposed to a person perspective out, right? So if you can, once you say, well, here are the carbon limits, here are the phosphorus limits, right, here's the state of the world's forests, they have to be maintained at least this state, then what kind of economic system evolves within those constraints, I'm not willing to prescribe. But you have to, the starting point has to be different of analysis.
Without asking you to prescribe, you've clearly thought about this a lot and over a great amount of time in perhaps a Quebec context, a northeastern U.S. context. Relative to the audience here, if the ethos of fairness is a central element of this, and as an earlier questioner put it, the third world wants to come up to where we are. Part of your reply was a redistribution of wealth.
Yeah, but coming to where we are is a biophysical impossibility.
Indeed, right. But right. You earlier commented on there are too many extremely wealthy people. Looking at the crowd here tonight, just from what you can gather, how low does our standard of living drop to allow others to come up to a level at which there is balance without further growth but greater fairness, as you seem to have suggested?
Well, at first place, I take on the concept of standard of living, I guess, as to whether that's really that closely connected to income. I think you can have a very high standard of living and not necessarily a lot of money. So I think that we have to disconnect those ideas from each other in an important way. But it's in part an analytical question to which I don't know the answer. I mean, if you took, let's say, James Hansen's goal of 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you said, okay, that's the global allocation. That's all that there can be. And emissions of different countries have to be set to stay in that sort of constraint. Then countries have got a choice as to how they reach that, stay within that limit. They can reduce their population, they can reduce their wealth, they can change their technology, or they can change their conduct. So a country like the United States, or Canada, or any country, is going to then have to say, okay, well, which mix of those variables are we going to play with to live within the limit? So I don't think there's a way a priori to say, well, incomes have to drop from $75,000 a year to $15,000 a year, because it's a mix of the other three variables that lead you to that place. And I think that those can be democratically decided once the constraint is imposed. So there is now negotiation just in the last day or two about whether it'll ever work or not, it's another question, but about holding global temperature increase to 2 degrees. Okay, if the only way that can be accomplished is to hold carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere at somewhere around 450, climate models aren't good enough to really say exactly where that is, Well, if the world community gets to that place, then countries or people will have allocations, and they'll have to live within them. And you can make your own choice about whether you want to be rich. You want to have a lot of people in the United States, or you want to have somewhat fewer people and be richer. By the time this question gets on the table, I'm not going to be around, but that's going to be the question.
I think I can add something good. I'm in agreement with everything I've heard here, and certainly with the goals. At heart, you're suggesting that we get out of siloed and separated thinking, look deeply in nature and the patterns, and accept full responsibility. I work in the clean technology space and with emerging and creative companies, and I'm seeing some very fundamentally creative new models. Mm-hmm. I have a client today that has demonstrated fusion, and I just found out today they've gotten their Series A funding. I know of many companies that are looking beyond photovoltaics into blended photovoltaics and solar thermal, where you take electricity off the front and thermal off the back, and you get much higher efficiencies. I know a company who, through nanotechnology and biomimicry, has found a way to purify water with 90% less energy. I could go on. None of them are done. None of them are easy. But we can try. We can keep trying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
Peter, we have reached that point where I'd like to give you a minute or two to, let's say, have us leave with a key thought or two that you'd like to really have us contemplate. Out of all the many fine sharings you've had for us tonight in this comprehensive view, what are a couple of things that you'd like to leave us with particularly?
Well, I wasn't ready for that question, but I guess just reflecting on it quickly, I live in Canada now, born in the United States. One of the many attractive things about the United States is a can-do culture, right? And, you know, this is the biggest challenge that the human race has ever faced. And this country should be a leader in that. And the people, this state is a leader, right? One of the things that really has set the benchmark for environmental quality in many areas is what California's done, right? Because Canada is a small part of the automobile market, for instance, right? Whatever California does, if the U.S. does it, Canada will do it, right? So there's an opportunity for leadership in this country. There's the culture of this country has this can-do spirit. That's got both positive and negative features, but it's a possible foundation for the kind of change the world needs, and I hope America's up to it.
Let's put our hands together for Peter Brown, please. I want to thank Peter Brown, who's a professor at McGill University in Montreal, Canada, for sharing with us tonight about building a whole earth economy. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.